From the Sky News Centre at 6, parts of the country battered by Storm Ciara are bracing themselves for more heavy rain. Storm Dennis is expected to cause worse flooding when it hits this weekend. Health officials have issued advice to hundreds of people who attended a conference in London after a visitor developed coronavirus. Those who were at last week's UK bus summit are described as having a slightly increased risk. Two Labour MPs are among those taking precautions. Meanwhile, a shortage of face masks as a result of the outbreak is worrying dentists. Linda Cruz from the British Dental Association says surgeries could start closing.
We are regulated to wear those masks, so without those masks, it's actually going to be very difficult to actually conform to the regulations and therefore to treat patients. So we're in a bit of a difficult situation.
A couple wanting doctors to continue life support treatment for their brain-dead son have lost another battle at the Court of Appeal. Three judges ruled stopping life support treatment is the best thing for four-month-old Midra Ali. His parents from Manchester were challenging an earlier ruling and still hope their son will get better. Our health correspondent Ashish Joshi is following the case.
It's a devastating blow for the family. They feel that Midra Ali is still growing and that there's a possibility that his condition could improve. The doctors think it's in the child's best interests if this ventilation, this life support machine, is switched off.
The body of a British woman who went missing in New Zealand has been found. 32-year-old Stephanie Simpson went hiking in the Mount Aspiring National Park last weekend. Police are investigating a complaint of racist language used during Kilmarnock's Scottish Premiership home win over Rangers yesterday. The Glasgow club striker Alfredo Morelos was the subject of the alleged abuse. And Batman fans have been given the chance to see Robert Pattinson in the iconic suit for the first time. The film's director has released a video clip of his camera test. That's the latest. I'm Anna Bates.
Yes, it's Friday. It's 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Henbury and Brentree, Chris Windows. The campaign against tower blocks, it's Matthew Montague Pollock, and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the US-owned Comcast News at 7, with US elections looming, the EU at last are taking a look at Google's secret search algorithms, which can skew results 30% for or against any particular candidate, twisting the views of journalists and voters. Meanwhile, will Bernie Sanders get to stand in a fair fight against Trump at last? And the Munich Security Conference this weekend, in the birthplace of the Nazi Party, Munich, of course. Something between Davos and Bilderberg. What are tech giants, though, like Facebook and Zuckerberg, and weighing in there for, whilst facing a $3 billion bill for unpaid tax in the United States? What trades is Zuckerberg up to at Munich this weekend? And Turkey's President Erdogan supplying weapons and ammunition to the terrorists in Syria's Idlib, exacerbating a mass exodus of civilians from the city, while stopping the last remnants of ISIS mercenary army being wiped out. And rigid type has the chutzpah to then threaten Assad and the Syrian Arab army if they threaten the Turkish soldiers who are helping the terrorists in Assad's own country. Our state retirement age is 66, as Macron caves in this week to the strikers and agrees not to raise the pension age in France from 60 to 62. Why can't we manage to do that sort of thing here in Britain? And the coronavirus begins to look like it's being contained a bit through tough action by the Chinese authorities. Is it time to say well done to President Xi? Also, was Boris right or wrong to clear out Sajid Javid's special advisers from his treasury? Who are these Sir Humphreys? Like special advisers, anyway, who often stay while elected ministers come and go. Could our senior politicians just be frontmen for powerful families and wealthy owners of our country coordinating policy from behind the scenes? Surely not. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So tonight, lows around 10 Celsius, light rain. This weekend, around 12, a little bit warmer. Strong winds, though, and heavy rain tomorrow. Next week, highs around 10 Celsius, some sunshine, rain, and windy at times. Next weekend, the 22nd and 23rd of February, highs around 11 Celsius, sunny spells, showers, and windy. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news, it's Conservative Councillor for Henbury and Brentree, Chris Windows. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi there. Good evening, all.
And what about this? The big news of this week, really, is the reshuffle. Am I right in thinking that when the Conservative Party elected Boris as the leader, not Jeremy Hunt, or anybody else, that it's taken a little while for his power to sort of trickle down through the system. And this is him now saying, right, well, I'm going to make sure I've got people in place in Downing Street and in Westminster, in the Cabinet, who are going to bring forward my policy. And that really is sweeping out all the old Theresa May types. Am I right? Sum it up like that?
I think if you're going to be Prime Minister, you've got to be a bit ruthless. And in fact, if you're not a bit ruthless, you would never get to be Prime Minister.
Well, some would say that about Jeremy Corbyn, wouldn't they? He wasn't ruthless enough with his own party.
I don't talk about Jeremy Corbyn.
Martin?
Well, I think that, you know, the basic rules of politics are the same for everybody. You've got to try and build consensus and you've got to try and get what you want through. And actually, that's quite tricky.
Well, that sounds a bit like kumbaya, doesn't it?
I'm just saying it's like the rules of football. There are two goals and you've got to kick it from one end to the other. But the strategies are endless. And some people are good at it and some people are not so good.
What do you think about what Chris has said there about that you actually do have to be a bit ruthless?
Well, of course you do. I mean, politics is not for those for shrinking violets, is it? Let's face it. You know, you have to take an awful lot of abuse, whoever you are, whatever your particular orientation. And, you know, for some people, it's not what they want to do. And that does create problems because, of course, the wrong people end up in power quite frequently because they're the people that want it.
This is national stuff, Martin. Before I come back to you, Chris, Martin, this is national stuff. Does local politics really matter nowadays?
Not really, not in this country. It's a centralised system. What's very clear from a political science point of view is back in the 1970s, we used to talk about the decline of cabinet government. And, you know, because traditionally the theory was that the Prime Minister was primus inter pares, first among equals, and that the cabinet was basically running the country, and the Prime Minister was basically the chair of the cabinet. That's all gone. Dominic Cummings has basically told Johnson who he wants out. He had a fallout with Savid Javid some while ago, and basically he's insisted that he's had to go. Of course, nobody's voted for Cummings.
Well, that isn't quite true, is it? That's not quite true. He's not insisted that Savid Javid goes. He's saying that you can stay, but I don't trust your advisors.
Well, what happened was, if you remember, is that Cummings called one of Javid's advisors in and gave them a telling off. And I can't remember, you know, this has been coming for a while. Basically, what it means is the power of the Treasury, of the Chancellor of the Exchequer, is being subsumed under that of the Prime Minister. And if you think about it, historically, you've had fights between Blair and Brown, between Margaret Thatcher and Lawson. You know, it's a standard battle. And of course, what Cummings and Johnson are doing here is they're making absolutely sure that everybody knows who the daddy is from the get-go. And, of course, they're going to have to take all the blame for any decisions.
What do you make of that, Chris?
Well, I've never met Mr. Cummings. A bit remiss on his part, I suppose, really. I could have given him a fair bit of advice, but as we haven't spoken, I'm not in that position. But I wouldn't argue with what my friend has just said. I think it's quite true.
But you think he's got to get the knives out? This is necessary, is it? I mean, what do you make about Sajid Javid, though? Because do you think it was a kind of constructive dismissal that he's just made it impossible for him to carry on, or is it that Sajid Javid is basically more loyal to his advisers than he is to Boris?
Although he originates from Bristol, I've never met the former Chancellor either. But he seemed to me to be a man of principle, And it's almost a shame if a man of principle leaves office.
So I suppose that's what's happened, really, is that Boris has said to Sajid Javid, you've got to choose, it's either them or me.
Well, he obviously chose.
He did. Okay. What about Martin's point about local government really not having any power now nowadays?
Well, we've gone down the same sort of road, really, because we used to have a committee system. Then we had the cabinet system, which wasn't as good, in my opinion. And now we've got dictatorship. Oh, sorry. No, I'm not supposed to say that, am I? Sorry.
Can you just tell us the difference between the first two, the committee system and then the cabinet system? Because it seems to me over the years, what you're intimating there is that power has been being controlled more and more into fewer and fewer hands in the city.
Well, exactly, yeah. With the committee system, there were committees which were basically a mix of different political opinions. As a result of that, you tended to get some decisions which were held up because they couldn't get agreement on them, and other decisions that were pretty democratic. Where you get the cabinet system, the ruling party decides, basically. They pay lip service to listening to what other people say, but basically they take the decisions. And when they move on to an elected mayor, and the elected mayor takes the decisions. That's what they used to have a different name for that, certainly back in the 1940s.
So it is becoming a bit like a dictatorship, you think? So it's just Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor, is making almost all the decisions to do with, where the money, and basically it's the money, where's the money spent, I suppose. That's the big thing, isn't it?
Yes, and also when it's an election year, it's always good to be seen to be doing wonderfully good things, even if they don't work out in the end. But if you've already been re-elected by them, it doesn't matter, does it?
How long have you been doing this job, Chris?
Oh, gosh. Oh, before I left school, was it? No, it just seems a long time ago. I'll have been 11 years in Bristol as a councillor come May.
And what do you make of this whole mayor system? I know you've never had a Conservative mayor, have you? And maybe that's why you don't like it.
No, it's not that. It was the Conservatives that came up with the idea, unfortunately. I have always been quite open as far as an elected mayor is concerned. I didn't agree with it. I was against it on principle, and I've never supported it. I was in a very, very tiny minority to start with, but I'm not now.
So your party is now actually saying that they don't want an elected mayor, even though you were instrumental, Conservatives were, in bringing it about in the first place.
Well, the government was. Central government brought it about, and people supported them.
So what was the argument at the time, and what's gone so wrong?
Well, the reason that they brought in the mayors? I don't know, really. Ask me about Syria.
Okay. The argument I've heard is that things like decisions about, for example, do you remember the debacle with the tram in the city? Oh, we're going to have a tram, we're not going to have a tram. These sorts of things would have been decided rather than split down party lines and postpone decisions forever. So the idea is that decisions actually do get made rather than everything gets mired down in this party political bureaucracy.
I thought that was why we'd got hold of a metro mayor to make decisions on transport.
Okay. Well, that's happened since all the messing around with the tram. But anyway, we're also joined this evening by Matthew Montague Pollock, who's been campaigning around the idea of tower blocks. And before we speak to him, Chris, I wonder if you've seen any difference in the way that planning decisions have been made since the mayoral system has come in, or is it all just simply that is just simply the same? Because I know that the mayor has taken quite a big role in pushing some big new developments across the city, particularly, well, there's obviously the Temple Island thing recently, which used to be called Arena Island. It's now Temple Island. And then the massive development that's planned for Hotwell's area, now called Western Harbour. So what have you seen changes in the way that the planning's dealt with?
Yes, I have. Planning is a statutory body where there should be no whipping. politics shouldn't come into it. And shall we say, if I had a call from one of your local competitors over the air saying that I was being accused of being political because I had basically proposed sending back an application because it didn't comply with the local plan, then you think there was pressure coming from somewhere politically? Politically different to my own political views, which are not tremendously strong, but they are there.
So you're not really supposed to be expressing views then on whether you support or don't support a particular planning application. Like, so for example, now, if I was to ask you about Western Harbour, you might have to think carefully about how you dealt with my question rather than just say exactly what you think about it.
Well, yes, there are rules. The law says that you must not prejudge any application. You must sit and listen to all the evidence and make your mind up at the time. If you've publicly stated a strong view one way or another, then you should announce that at the start of the meeting, and you should not take any part in the discussions regarding that particular application or the vote at the end of it.
Because these planning decisions are interesting, aren't they, in that there's massive amounts of money rides on whether the council recommends it, votes for it or against it. I mean, we can be talking about tens of millions of pounds,
yes,
in someone's pocket or not at the end of the evening.
Yes, that's true.
Matthew, anyway, why is it that you're so against the whole idea of building up? Because it's an obvious thing to do in a city, isn't it? There's limited space. We need more housing, for example. The obvious way to go is up.
Yeah. First, I'd like to second what other people have said about the mayoral system. The problem I see is that although getting stuff done is one of its advantages, arguably, getting mistakes done is also a big advantage. And under the current administration, there's been an enormous intolerance for criticism. And actually, our mayor gets basically very angry when people just simply criticize him and treats it as political ping pong when opposition councillors come up with perfectly sensible criticisms. But as to the high-rise issue, I mean, it's a whole bunch of issues. One is we have a beautiful city in the center, and that beauty attracts people here to work here. They come here, and this is certainly true of people my age. Lots of people have come here for that reason, and also people who settle for jobs because it's an attractive place to live. It's also much cheaper than London still. So this is a key asset for us, and it will continue paying dividends so long as we continue to keep it reasonably attractive. So just to say, okay, we've got to build high and we've got to sell off, we've got to build in the center because that's where the land is worth the most money, so we can sell off the land in the center to developers and it'll make us lots of profits for the city, doesn't make sense. So that's, I suppose, my main reason, which is the attractiveness of the city. But it is also true that high-rises for residential use are not good for whole categories of people. They're obviously not good for mothers with children. You can't let your kids play around a high-rise. You've got to go down yourself. You can't just let them out. Also, they are lonelier. There's been a whole lot of stuff about people leaving envelopes in corridors. Do they get picked up and returned to the post office? Well, at the top of high-rises, weirdly, they get picked up less. People are less pro-social. They know their neighbours left. So they're called suburbs in the sky because they have, in a way, the same problems as suburbs in which people arrive by car, go into their house, shut the door, etc. So that's another thing. Another issue is they are more expensive to build. Let's say 40% more expensive for a really tall building. So if you want affordable housing,
but the land is cheaper, isn't it?
The land
is buying
cheaper.
The one piece of land. So
you
this
buy
is why
the one piece
this is why the speculators love them.
Well, yeah. If the city indicates that there's going to be high rise in a particular area, the land shoots up in price. So it gets sold on and on and on, and it becomes actually very expensive.
So anyway, have you had any successes with actually limiting some of the high rise buildings in the city?
Have I what?
Had any successes in limiting some of this high rise building in the
city? Yeah, I think Bedminster is doing very well. Windmill Hill. That hill is just about to have three or four 22-story high-rises blocking their view, and some of them are just very ugly and very badly built with very little light.
And can't these high-rises work if there's a bit of space between them? And, you know, some, in some parts of the city, in existing, say, Barton Hill, not far from us here, it seems to be work because they're not crammed together. There's a bit of space.
Yeah, well, you could argue, okay, that's true, but one of the points which has been made about the 60s and 70s high-rises is that actually the amount of density you get on a particular bit of land is not bigger because you're giving the space than classical mid-rise housing. I mean, I live in High Kingstown, and there's a whole lot of high-rises on the top of that hill. They are less dense than the preceding Georgian houses or than our two-story houses, amazingly, even though they're high-rise.
And now I know you're organising some event, aren't you, in a few weeks' time, which is really designed to bring together some expertise in the city and focus on this. But before you tell us about that, Chris, maybe you could let us know what you make of this. I mean, when it comes to giving planning permission, surely the developers can pretty much build what they want. I mean, there are planning guidance and they know that, and they will build pretty much whatever they want. It's their land. And also, if the council tries to appeal, you know, then they are going to maybe take you to appeal and win. And it's going to be a big bill for the city council. The council can't appeal the decision if it goes in their favour. So the whole system is skewed against the city council. So don't you ever feel like giving up and thinking, well, they can just build what they want?
No, I never give up. I have two high rises in my ward. There are all sorts of problems associated with them. I've actually spoken to the mayor for council about the amount of dog feces and urine that is in the lifts, on the floors, etc. I did ask him if he supported having dogs in high-rise flats, because having been a dog owner, I'm not now, but I was, I wouldn't have one if I lived in a high-rise flat. It's cruel to an animal to have him up right up in the air where you're not going to take him for his proper walks, because you've got a hell of a lot of messing about to do. Some people might, mightn't they?
They might actually do that, bother to take him for a walk.
Well, I know full well that many don't. There's also the social problems associated. Where there are dogs allowed in high-rise flats, there are associated problems with people who sell stuff that we don't like.
You mean drugs?
Yes. If they can't, well, some people like them, but I don't. Jesse Odd Aspirin. I have to say that where there are no dogs allowed, you won't find drugs being sold, because the people that sell them will always have at least one animal. It's protection, I presume. The high-rise flats I'm talking about in my ward used to have a no-dogs policy. That was reversed by the council. I don't know why. Somebody said that it was something to do with the human rights.
Do you know, Matthew?
I have no idea.
Okay. Anyway, do you want to just tell us about this event? Who's going to be coming there? I know it's down at the Arnolfini.
On March the 5th.
That's a Thursday.
Which is a Thursday. And I'd just like to say it's only £6. And tickets are selling fast. It's 7 o'clock in the evening. And it really will be the first and maybe last chance to hear what's basically the anti-high-rise case, because this city has been, through the mayor and through Nicola Beach, the chief planning officer, very insistent on pushing this idea that a progressive city builds high, and this is what we have to do. We have to catch up with Birmingham. We have to catch up with Manchester. And so we've gone out and got four people really from the top flight, the head of the real estate section of Bartlett, which is the most prestigious architecture school in the country, a guy called Professor Stedman, also from UCL, who will show you that high-rise buildings use twice as much energy, so they're not at all sustainable. One of the things the mayor gets wrong and is kept on saying is that they're better for the environment. This is just not true. They use much more energy. So those are two of the people.
Well, Nicola Beach, you mentioned. I mean, I've approached her many times to come on this program, right, but she's never replied to me in the last, 4 years or something. Mm. Her role, she's a Labour councillor for St George Central. What is her role, Chris?
She's
spatial planning and city design in the cabinet.
She's in the cabinet. Basically, she confers with her colleagues and they decide what path they wish to go down, having been, I'm sure, helpfully advised by the mayor.
I mean, it does seem to me that that Nicola and Marvin Rees, the mayor, are really doing what the developers want. So they've gone to the developers and they've said, or the speculators, effectively, these people are, and they've said, well, what would you like to do in Bristol and how can we get the most buildings built? And they've said, well, we'd like to do this, we'd like to do that. And then Marvin and Nicola seem to be coming in behind them. Is that a fair thing to say?
I couldn't argue with it.
Matthew, what do you
think? Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's exactly how you shouldn't plan a town. You've got to think creatively about how to do it and where you want to put people. And a big opportunity, for instance, is St. Philip's. And some people will really hate what I'm going to say, but I think St. Philip's needs to be the new centre of Bristol. It's just next to the station. It's next to... it's got a big road around it. It's next to water. It's a tremendous opportunity. You could fit 40,000 people there, and they could be mid-rise. Instead of just saying to developers, okay, put a high-rise in Bedminster, put a high-rise next to Castle Park, put a high-rise over there, we'll be okay with it, and dotting them all over the place. You've got to think systematically about where you're going to put stuff. And that is not being done because we're... victims were in the hands of the developers. Of course, if you just give it over to the developers, it gets more stuff done quicker. But you then got to live with it. And once you put up a high rise, it's going to be there for 300 years.
Can you just remind us where and when this is all happening? Thursday?
Thursday, the 5th of March at 7 o'clock. If you go to either to the Arnolfini site, you can book a ticket, or to the Bristol Civic Society site, you can book tickets. And I hope you'll come, please, or everyone in the studio.
Well, I can't come because I won't be here. I'm on the holiday. Sorry about that, Matthew.
Lucky you. Okay.
I don't get holidays.
Well, I haven't for a while. But Martin Summers, can you just give us your view, just overall view of this whole relationship? Because the speculators and the developments seem to be calling the shots city right now.
What's increasingly been happening is that central government has basically been cutting back its funding for local government. Now, then, of course, you've also brought in this idea of an entrepreneurial mayoral function. And of course, the obvious thing to do, if you're running a relatively successful city like Bristol, is to go with the developers so that you can get all the business rates in, and then you can pay to keep your social services running, which would otherwise have to go down the drain. Yeah. So I take the criticisms of Marvin's... I don't believe in elected mayors. Marvin knows my views. I've never believed in them. I don't believe in them now. But we're stuck with it. The situation is where it is. We're kind of stuck with it. And I think what I do really object to is, instead of turning round to the Labour voters in the city and saying, actually, with all this money being cut back from central government, there isn't really a lot we can do. we can hold the line in some respects, but there's a temptation to be entrepreneurial, to go out and do new stuff, which has been picked up from the previous mayor, the idea that mayors are there to sort of float around the place doing clever stuff. Whereas in actual fact, what I would expect the leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council to do is give us the blood, sweat and tears speech. We can't do much, but we're just gonna stick our ground. And unfortunately, of course, that what's going to happen is that unsuccessful cities or towns like Middlesbrough will gradually crash down the hole because the money's not going to be coming from central government. This is the problem that's having local government funded through local taxation, even if they've got business rates, is that it's massively unfair. South Wales will be wiped out. Bristol will survive, but by building high and doing all these things. Yeah, but all of it's wrong. We shouldn't be running the country like that, never mind Bristol.
Chris?
Yeah, so I'm a little bit loath to go too hard on the developers because it should be a proper symbiotic relationship, really. We really need the developers, but they need the city, and the two should work together, and that doesn't always happen.
There seems to be a lot of focus on all this, Martin. In a way, this is it seems like the last days of Rome, because you've got the rentier economy seems to be driving everything now. The idea that you can put up a building, leave it there for whatever, 50 years, 100 years, and then just without actually putting in any particular effort, just get loads and loads of rent money for it, seems to be the prime driving force nowadays.
It's technically called fire insurance and real estate, fire sector. And, of course, what's happened in this country and in the US in particular is this sector has become predominant. And there's if you look at classical economics, and there's a guy, professor called Michael Hudson in the US who's very good on this, classical economists like Adam Smith and Marx and others were clear that there's unproductive and productive investments. A lot of investments are essentially rent-seeking investments. They're not building a better widget. It's basically just controlling positional goods.
So this is becoming that one of the main driving forces behind the entire economy. Never mind service industry, never mind manufacturing. We're building office blocks and housing blocks.
That's what we've got, is a massive housing bubble in this country. And it will burst at some point, but by that stage, the people who have invested in that will have made a fortune through not producing a better widget. And of course, one of the problems with doing that is that if you are trying to, you know, if you're an entrepreneur who wants to build a better widget, it's a waste of, you know, you can't make money doing that. If you can make more money building buildings, with, you know, basically this technology of building buildings doesn't advance that
much. So you're saying that if someone has got, whatever it is, £20 million in their pocket or £200 million in their pocket, the best way to make some money out of that is property speculation now.
Well, indeed. That, of course, then squeezes out the more entrepreneurial activity where you're developing small and medium enterprises.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think part of the problem has been that there is large lumps of money, lumpy cash, which has been looking for places to invest. What better than a high rise? You can put a lot of money into it. And over the last 20 years, you've also seen huge property appreciation as interest rates have come down. Now, it is arguable, and one of our speakers, this woman from the Bartlett School, will say that the time of property appreciation is coming to an end because interest rates have gone down as far as they possibly can. I mean, they're actually negative. So that should mean that the prices stop rising, and that will mean that people will look more at actual yields, the return on capital. And yields are higher in lower-rise building.
But for most people, Matthew, they don't think they can make any difference to this. What's the point in coming down to your talk?
Well, it's a question of understanding it. You know, the propaganda that we need these things because we've got limited space is so strong. And I find when I'm out talking to people, they look at me astonished and say, but we got limited space. We got to build high. A very, you know, very simple thing. But the fact is that you can get as much density on the same space if you build mid-rise as if you build high-rise, because you need the light, you need the space around it, you need the schools, you need the parks. The whole equation has to be looked at. And mid-rise is as efficient.
Now, I can remember when I lived in Northern Ireland reading a study, American study, saying that with chimpanzees, that if you put too many of them in the same cage, this is a sort of nasty experiment, you know, where they put a few more chimpanzees every week into the same cage. When you get to a certain density, then they start actually attacking and killing each other. So this thing of density really is important. It makes a lot of sense. And what we're seeing is a lot of more student flats being built. Yeah. Now, the rules for student flats mean you can cram an enormous number of people into a tiny amount of space. And one wonders that if the student, a massive number of students expected into the city either doesn't materialise or it starts to fall off, you know, with a virus like this thing we've had, that actually ordinary people will be happy to be living in those appallingly dense conditions as well.
Mm. Of course, there's also that correlate, you know, the very high student suicide rate. Actually, no one's done any work correlating buildings and student suicides, but there is a correlation between tall buildings and slightly higher suicides.
Okay, and have you got a website or something people can find you, Matthew?
Just Google Bristol campaign against tower blocks.
Okay, your favourite search engine, folks, not necessarily Google, which we'll be talking about in the second hour. But I'm joined on the line by Ian Henshaw from Brighton. Hi, Ian. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Yeah, hello. You're very faint, Tony, but you're just about there. I don't know what I'm sounding like.
You sound fine, Ian. Can you just take us through what happened? Because we saw you, you're an old friend of this programme, talking about the 9/11 attacks in your book, 9/11, The Real Evidence, and various other things that you've done on that. But apparently the coronavirus chappie that came into Britain was a next-door neighbour of yours. So can you just take us through this?
But it's just an extraordinary coincidence. And I first realized this when the media started coming around. Oh, you know, does Mr. Walsh live next door? And I was prepared to talk to them a little bit. It was clear that their agenda was to create panic. So I thought...
Hang on. What makes you say that?
Well, because they used the word panic in all their reports. They said Hove's panicking, Brighton's panicking. And they weren't the only people panicking with the Daily Mail Online, as far as I could see, and the rest of the journalists... So I thought it was time to puncture that little bubble. So I went out and said, I didn't think they'd cover this. I went out and said, well, this is a rubbish story. I used the word rubbish. And there it was on the BBC News, national news.
We didn't see you on Channel 4, though, did we?
Sorry? I boycotted Channel 4 in protest against their reporting on Syria, where they've been effectively supporting the terrorists.
Anyway, look, you've spoken to this chap. What's his name? You've spoken to his wife, and you've emailed with him. Can you just take us through what their experience is of being the great coronavirus carrier, bringing this terrible, deadly virus to Britain?
Yeah, well, they've asked me not to talk, so I don't want to give you huge details, but basically, you know, they feel pretty... I mean, when you go into quarantine with all your windows drawn and the children, you know, they've got a couple of children aged about, you know, 12 and 9 or something, and the poor little kids were there, you know, in the house with all the media standing outside. I think they've been feeling pretty miserable. But now it's more or less all over. But they were getting advised by a public relations company who, you know, might not have had their best interests at heart. They were hired by Steve's employer, and they've gone around trying to tell everybody not to talk to the media. I think, you know, in terms of what is going on, I mean, let's wait for the biologists and the cellular biologists and the DNA experts. I'm sure we'll find out more as time goes on.
So anyway, the guy's name is Steve Walsh. He's linked to 11 cases in the UK, France and Mallorca. It sounds like he's one of these carriers that, you know, if he'd have gone wandering around the London Underground, the whole country would have caught this.
Well, I don't think, you know, some people don't pick things up, some people don't. Yeah, I think you've got to be quite close up to somebody for a while. The other astonishing thing is there's been the most incredible wave of anti-Chinese propaganda in the US media. Although China's been totally praised by the World Health Organization and other experts for their, you know, radical and timely measures to stop the disease spreading, according to the New York Times, you know, If the Chinese do anything to stop it, they're draconian and authoritarian. And if they don't do anything, they're feckless and irresponsible. So they totally can't win.
Well, another thing I've heard, Ian, is that people are not buying as many Chinese meals because they're worried that the people preparing them might have the virus.
Yeah. I mean, the level of panic, is that's why I went out there. I mean, you do take a risk when you speak to the media, but I just thought, well, you know, if they don't get me, they're going to get somebody on a phone in, you know.
I mean, one thing would be really helpful to hear from you is just how badly, you know, was he extremely ill and his wife or not?
No, he wasn't. That was the whole thing. He was barely it. You know, I mean, the problem in a way is that now that they've got all the panic going, people imagine that if you've got it, you know, you're on death's door straight away, and you're not. In Steve's case, the symptoms were less severe than you would get from flu.
Amazing. Anyway, let's have a listen to someone who is a bit of an expert. I mean, he's his name is Dr. Chris Busby, and he's one of the leading campaigners of against the nuclear industry as an environmental scientist, helping people to really to expose things like leukemia clusters around nuclear power stations. And he is. I spoke to him earlier this week from his home at the moment, which is over in Riga in Latvia. So let's hear what Dr. Chris Busby has to say about coronavirus. Is there anything people can do if they're concerned about this? Because some people have suggested that actually wearing a face mask is really just a psychological thing. It doesn't stop the virus.
No, I think it probably does, actually. I mean, that isn't true for all sorts of radiation and so forth, but in this case, I think it probably would be valuable. The virus would be transmitted by aerosol, by spray. So somebody sneezing at you, and you could get the virus. So if you're wearing a face mask, it won't get through the face mask because it's just a little water droplet. So I think that probably would be useful.
Any other precautions, do you think, if people get concerned?
Certainly usual precautions for viruses. You know, you wash your hands, you don't move, you know, all the time, because we're always taking our hands up to our faces and blowing our noses and this and that. And then if you sort of shake hands with somebody or if you touch somebody, the virus would be communicated to your hands and so forth. So if you wash them, you wash the virus off. Really simple stuff, in fact. We've been here before, you know, with Ebola and SARS and pig flu and goodness knows what. And so, you know, and very often they just turn out to be nothing at all. Few people die, and that's the end of that. So I don't know. But on the other hand, you know, at some point in time, this could easily be like one of those dreadful films, you know, that used to be shown in which everybody dies. This is an HIV-tagged virus, right? So in other words, the first thing it does is it binds to the T cells, which are the immune system killer cells for viruses. So, you know, so if you like to think of yourself as the man, you know, as sort of like some kind of Doctor Strangelove or, you know, Goldfinger type character who wants to wipe out everybody in the world, this is how you'd go about it. You'd build a virus that had an immune system destructor to begin with, and then you'd send it out there.
Well, that's Dr. Chris Busby. Ian, I wonder what you make of that.
Well, I think there's some truth in that, you know, that could be why, you know, a legitimate explanation for the panic is that they've realized that this isn't it, but at some point in the future, you know, something like this could happen. And there's a wonderful book by Gore Vidal called Kalki, which is a fictional. I won't give away too much because it's the most amazing ending. But if anybody sees that book, I definitely would recommend it. It's a good read, you know, a real thriller on that subject.
Okay, your book, just remind us of your 9/11 book's title.
9/11, The New Evidence. 9/11 Revealed was serialized, believe it or not, in the Daily Mail, which killed me with The Guardian, unfortunately, who I'd rather be in. Not that The Guardian's that great nowadays. Then I brought out by myself 9/11, The New Evidence.
Well, you mentioning The Guardian, I mean, that's where George Monbiot published his swinging hatchet job attack on Chris Busby. Monbiot then came out as someone who was supporting the nuclear industry, as an environmentalist supporting the nuclear industry.
Monbiot, I'm sorry to say, is not very well informed about some things. He certainly wasn't very well informed about 9/11. He used up two huge pages of The Guardian on 2 weeks successively to attack 9/11 skeptics. And his information, because I'm actually, you know, researched the subject, unlike him, I knew that where his information was coming from, because it was false information, and it was coming from a right-wing newspaper in America owned by the Hearst Corporation. So, you know, how somebody on The Guardian can A, trust anything that comes out of the Hearst Corporation, and B, you know, accepts it and doesn't do any further research. It's absolutely shocking.
Okay, well, Ian Henshaw from Brighton, author of 9/11 and New Evidence, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Chris, this is, I suppose, the time where we might actually congratulate the Chinese, because we're seeing the first time, for example, in Beijing, I think it's in Beijing or Shanghai, one of the big cities, no new cases over the last couple of days of this. And it looks as if there's actually, you know, the way that the Chinese authoritarian government works is they really are trying to make sure that this doesn't spread anywhere outside China any more than it has already. What do you make of how they've dealt with it? And do you think we could do the same here in Bristol?
I think the most important thing is that get the panic out of the way. Most people are fairly sensible and they know the basic precautions to take to make sure that they are protected as much as possible from any of these diseases that spring up from time to time. I make it a golden rule now that I never kiss strangers.
Well, that's one way of doing it. Okay, look. Back to Prime Minister's, well, we'll start on Prime Minister's questions this week. A bit of a fuss between Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson about the Windrush generation people being sent back home.
Mr. Speaker, does the Prime Minister think that someone who came to this country at the age of five and was the victim of County Line's grooming and compelled to carry drugs, released 5 years ago, and never re-offended, deserves to be deported?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I think the whole country would agree that while I cannot comment on individual cases, it is entirely right that foreign national offenders should be deported from this country in accordance with the law.
Jeremy Corbyn. The government has learned absolutely nothing from the Windrush scandal. This cruel and callous government is trying to mislead the British people into thinking it's solely deporting foreign nationals who are guilty of murder, rape and other very serious offences. This is clearly not the case. Take the example of a young black boy who came to the UK aged five and is now being deported after serving time for a drugs offence. If there was a case of a young white boy with blonde hair, who later dabbled in Class A drugs and conspired with a friend to beat up a journalist, would he deport that boy? Or, Mr. Speaker, is it one rule for young black boys from the Caribbean and another for white boys from the United States?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I think quite frankly that the Right Honourable Gentleman demeans himself and, by the way, besmirches the reputation of the Windrush generation who came to this country to work in our public services, to teach our children in this country, to make lives better for the people of this country. He has no right to conflate them with those foreign national offenders that we are deporting today.
Well, obviously, what Jeremy Corbyn's trying to do there is bring up the Prime Minister's own checkered history, because he did dabble with Class A drugs, and he did conspire with his friend Darius Guppy to beat up a journalist. That's just factual stuff. And, of course, he's never been punished for any of that. And, you know, is Britain a fair country? Is it one law for them and another one for us? The answer to that, of course, is yes.
What do you make of these deportations, Chris?
Well, as a white boy with not blonde but pretty pale coloured hair,
silver,
silver. I would hope I wouldn't get involved in that. But quite seriously, if the law says that something must be done, then it must be done. And if you don't agree with it or you think it's wrong, then you must campaign to change it. I'm not convinced that that's what Jeremy Corbyn was trying to do.
The new cabinet apparently is going to be two-thirds privately educated after the reshuffle, Martin, compared to 7% of the UK population that gets private education. Is it just because private educated people are better at running the country?
Well, I would obviously say no. The fact is that if you're privately educated, you get all sorts of advantages which allow you to end up in the cabinet, for example, or at the top of companies and all the rest of it. That doesn't mean that they're better. It just means that they've got a load of advantages. I mean, frankly, you see, we're talking about, you know, Michael Gove admitted, for example, that he'd taken cocaine. Was he arrested? The police should have gone round to his house and said, when did you take cocaine? Now, of course, this is the problem, isn't it? The white boys who take cocaine just get a slap on the wrist and nothing gets mentioned. But of course, if you're a lower class person with a different colour skin, then it's a big crime. All of the people in the US who are banged up in the private prisons tend to be the black boys. Everybody knows it.
And isn't that simply because of poverty? I mean, that leads us on to the next one, really, because we're about to talk about knife crime now. And surely this is just because we are a poorer society than we were, say, 15, 20 years ago. The increase in knife crime, Chris Windows from the Conservative Party here in Bristol, what do you make of why have we got this big increase in knife crime over the last, well, it's really since 2010 or so, more and more, it seems. But what's it all down to? What do you put it down to?
Knives are cheaper and more easily obtained than guns are. There are people that will resort to violence, whatever, and hope to get away with it. But when they do get away with it, it encourages other people to follow the same path. We need to find a different way of dealing with violent crime, just locking them up where they can learn new ways of misbehaving isn't working. It hasn't worked for a long time. So I don't know what the answer is, but we do have a lot of clever people in this country, and they should be able to come up with it.
I mean, the link between drugs and drug gangs and this, I mean, the fact that you've got so many people who don't have any money, they were likely to go straight to a drug gang and say, well, look, I need enough money this week, I'm going to become a drug dealer. I mean, this is just a normal thing that happens in a society where people can't find it, you know, almost impossible to pay the rent, even if they've got a reasonable job. Sometimes now they just don't have enough money to make ends meet. Playing into the hands of the gangs. This is organised crime is preying on our society now because people just don't have enough money to pay the bills.
Well, I was in the position in my younger days when I found it very, very difficult to pay some of the bills. Life was very, very difficult, and I can sympathise with people that are in that position now. But I never did any drugs, I never took any, and I was never tempted to run any drugs either. I think it just depends on your temperament and the way you were brought up, quite frankly.
You talk to the police, they'll say quite a lot of the violence is centred around nightclubs, not necessarily the bouncers. The bouncers are trying, I see you nodding there, the bouncers are trying to keep the violence down, but, you know, this is the nightclubs do tend to do that. Anyway, let's have a listen now to this Prime Minister's questions about knife crime this week.
Jacob Young.
On Thursday last week, two people were stabbed in Redcar in broad daylight. Another person was injured in a horrific knife crime on Saturday evening outside a busy nightclub. Figures released by the Ministry of Justice in January show that Cleveland Force area has the highest number of knife and offensive weapon offences per head of population in all of England and Wales. What additional support can my right honourable friend give to Cleveland Police to tackle this problem, and when will we start to see more police on the streets of Teesside?
Prime Minister!
Oh, Mr Speaker, I thank my honourable friend for raising it, because knife crime is intolerable and its recent rise must be combated. That's why we brought in knife prevention orders, which give the police the powers where they suspect a knife crime is about to be committed to take the interventions that they need. That's why we're putting 20,000 more police on our streets with the encouragement and the political support that they need to carry out stop and search.
Well, the 20,000 police, of course, are to make up for the 22,000 that have already been cut because of the economic policies that's been pursued over the last 10 years. Ultimately, what's happening is we're becoming more like the United States of America step by step. And the United States of America is becoming more like Latin America. And underlying all of this is partly the illegal drugs market, which actually underpins the financial sector since 2008. There was a report by the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, which came out in 2009, mostly written by police officers, very clear. The drug cartels washed their money through the banking system at that point with the full connivance of governments, because it was the way to keep the banking system going. And of course, the CIA have been very heavily involved in drug dealing all over the world since the 1940s. Everybody, the dogs in the street in Colombia know that Pablo Escobar worked for the CIA. Now, at the same time, we're locking up young people in this country for, smoking a joint. Meanwhile, the banks are run. I mean, Sir Philip Green, who's the head of HSBC. HSBC were convicted in the US of money laundering for the Zetas cartel, and his punishment was to be made an advisor to the government on tax reform. That's the reality. And drugs are part of our society now at every level.
Well, we shouldn't be too surprised about HSBC being used for laundering drug money, since that was what they were created for
indeed,
in the first
that's
place.
Right, of course.
And Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank in the opium wars right. was the main conduit for opium money.
Jardine Matheson and so on.
Anyway, and we've got another subject, final subject, HS2 approved this week. Before we hear from the House of Commons, Martin, good or bad? Chris, good or bad?
Okay, well... I haven't got all the details on it, and as long as it doesn't mean to say that all the money will disappear from this area of the country to go up north, I think it's good to have communications. Fully in favour of the railways, fully in favour of them being made a lot better than they are at the moment.
Well, that's the existing railways you're talking about. Do we need a new one, a faster one between London and Birmingham?
Well, apparently we do, yes.
I'm inclined to think of it as a white elephant, frankly.
Martin Vickers.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I support the Prime Minister's decision yesterday to go ahead with HS2, though I have to tell him that there is little enthusiasm among my constituents for it, because it does nothing to improve connectivity to Cleethorpes. To build up enthusiasm amongst the people of Cleethorpes, could I urge the Prime Minister to instruct LNER to reintroduce the direct train service from Cleethorpes through to King's Cross, to make the Gainsborough Brig to Cleethorpes service, which is at present one day a week, into a 7-day service, to manufacture the rails at Scunthorpe, and of course to reopen Suggetts Lane level crossing.
Mr. Speaker, the voice of Cleethorpes has been heard, and he's made a vivid and compelling case, as I stood up to answer, the Chancellor whispered in my ear that we would certainly be looking at it in the infrastructure review.
Well, there is no longer the Chancellor, so maybe they won't be looking at it in the infrastructure review. Anyway, I was in contact with Manfred Petrisch, who used to work in Swiss bank financing. And this is about 18 months ago. I interviewed him about HS2 when there was a report saying by ex-railway professional people who'd been involved in financing in this country that it was going to cost £111 billion. And he said this makes it by far the most expensive railway ever built. And for that amount of money, I could build a railway round the world. So it does seem as if there's a bit of a sniff of contract fraud, as Martin was saying, a white elephant here. Chris, what do you think?
Well, I know for a fact that all over the world, good railways are very, very expensive. They've got to be very expensive. I can't argue with whether she could build a... It was a lady, was it, you mentioned?
No. Manfred. Yes. Anyway, sorry, oh. That's all we got time for. Sorry. But anyway, I'd like to see the money spent on rejuvenating old railways and opening some. Anyway, thanks to our guests, Conservative Councillor for Henbury and Brentree, Chris Windows, also in the campaign against tower blocks, Matthew Montague Pollock. Join us after the US-owned Comcast News at 7 as we take our weekly look around the world.
Sky News Centre.